This is Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf, historian of early America.
I'm Ed Ayers, historian of 19th century America.
And I'm Brian Ballow, historian of everything that's happened since then. We're talking today about Thanksgiving. Before the break, we learned that the holiday tradition we celebrate today started in the 1800s, not in the 1600s. Sure, there have always been harvest feasts, and there were back in the pilgrim days, too. But for everything else, those pilgrims would have been just as likely to give thanks to God by declaring a fast, not a feast.
As it turns out, they weren't the only ones. There was some fasting going on down here in colonial Virginia, too. We found evidence of that in a document dated April 6, 1700.
A proclamation being prepared for a solemn fast and day of humiliation and prayer for the delivering of this colony from the great plague of caterpillars to be observed at James City.
That's right, caterpillars. In the spring of 1700, they came to Virginia in great numbers, devouring corn and tobacco fields. And so the governor, down in Williamsburg, declared a day of fasting and prayer that the caterpillars would go away. The declaration is being read here by Jim Horn, Vice President of Research at Colonial Williamsburg, where we recently paid him a visit.
And accordingly, I do hereby appoint that Friday, the third day of May next, be set apart and observed as a solemn day of fasting and humiliation for the purposes aforesaid.
After more than a year, their prayers were finally answered, and that led the governor to declare, in June of 1701, a public day of Thanksgiving.
Whereas it has pleased Almighty God of His infinite mercy to deliver this colony from the late great and raging plague of caterpillars with which it was infested in a humble sense thereof, it is ordered and appointed that the fifth day of June next be observed and kept by all inhabitants of the city of Williamsburg and parts adjacent as a day of thanksgiving.
Now, there's no mention of a fast in the second declaration, simply an order that all the king's subjects abstain from work and religiously attend the service of the day. Now, that might have meant they fasted, but it's also possible they feasted. The point is that in colonial America, Thanksgivings took both forms, and there was no one date set aside on the calendar for observing an annual Thanksgiving.
Well, now that we've cleared that up, there was one other question we wanted to answer while we were in Colonial Williamsburg. It involved the ritual most associated with modern Thanksgiving, the big bird at the center of it all.
The evidence says the turkey could have been on the table.
If there's anyone who would know what was on the table of colonial Americans, it's this woman.
My name is Joanne Bowen, and I'm curator of zooarchaeology. I identify all the bones that come out of the archaeological sites throughout the historic area.
Joanne Bowen has been working with bones for decades in Virginia as well as New England. She's currently sorting through bones found out back of an 18th century coffee house that was a popular haunt for members of Williamsburg's elite. Our producer, Tony Field, found Bowen in her lab, surrounded by drawers filled with cow bones, pig bones, turtle bones, and yes, big wild bird bones.
You know, most sites have one or two or more turkey bones in them. So
north and south.
North and south.
Mm-hmm. Any other wild birds that would have been eaten?
I would say by the late 17th century, I would say the wild ducks, the waterfowl. In the early sites, we have found the great blue heron, we have found the common loon, we have found the double-crested cormorant. There was a much broader sense of, you know, range of species that were consumed in that period.
This would have been in elite households?
Yes, yes. We know mostly the elite sites.
Okay.
And that's the bulk of what we've worked with. And then we're starting to get relatively large numbers of slave sites. But the middling farmer and the indentured servants and all, and the tenant farmers, we have so little data.
Why would you have so much more for the elite sites than the...
That's where the money has been.
For the research?
Yes. Uh-huh. So the archaeologist, you know, that's, you know, the sites that were being excavated. The other thing that we discovered is that the urban people consumed more wildlife than their rural counterparts.
Explain that.
I think there's a social reason that hunting was a favored sport, and wildlife was a sign of your status. From a nutritional point of view, it wasn't as important, but from a social point of view, it was maybe more important.
That's Joanne Bowen, curator of zooarchaeology at Colonial Williamsburg here in Virginia. You can see pictures of some of the bones in her lab at backstoryradio.org.
Joanne's theory that wild game was more a source of social status than of actual nutrition for colonial elites, well, it got us thinking about that original harvest festival back in 1621, the famous Massachusetts one where the Pilgrims and the Wampanoag Indians sat down and did lunch. Because for the Indians, wild game was an important source of nutrition. There's an historian at Texas State University named Jimmy McWilliams who thinks this difference is key to understanding what happened in the early years of settlement. He told me that the newcomers were totally cool with hunting as a leisure activity. Game parks, after all, were a favorite haunt of the aristas back in England, but food for them was the product of careful cultivation, be it of vegetables or of meat.
You know, the Puritans arrived in the New World with a set of very stringent cultural expectations. I mean, they wanted to be the city on the hill. And the last thing they wanted to do was to kind of, quote-unquote, devolve into, quote-unquote, a savage state.
Right.
And if you had to go out and actually hunt for your food, you know, if you had to dive into the woods out of necessity rather than for leisure purposes, well, this could easily be interpreted as a sign of cultural weakness or decline. And I think when they looked at the Wampanoags grabbing their arrows or grabbing their guns and running off into the woods for most of the day, they thought, well, wow, they're incredibly lazy. They should be home tending crops. And instead, you know, it is their women who are working in the fields.
Let's talk about corn a little bit. Corn has got enormous cultural significance.
Yeah, so the English, you know, the Puritans, when they arrived in New England, of course, were very familiar with corn. Generally, it was feed for farm animals in England. So, you know, the Puritans show up, and of course, they find that the Native Americans are growing it as more or less one of their staple foods. You know, that was jarring in and of itself. And I think, you know, this is an observation on the part of the Puritans that we really need to pay attention to, because a lot of times as we try to explain the failure of Native Americans and English to create any sort of biracial society, you know, a lot of times we just immediately look to race and assume that race was the determinative factor here. But if you look at the example of corn, I think there's a case to be made that it was, you know, agricultural practices and food that played a really important role in creating basic cultural differences, or at least the perception of basic cultural differences. But there's one more point to this, a connected point. It's not only the corn itself that I think influenced the way the English looked at the Native Americans, but it was also the way that they grew the corn. Native Americans had this agricultural method where they would clear a plot of land by girdling trees and burning the soil. The trees would die and fall. The ash in the soil would sort of work itself deeper into the topsoil. And then they would just throw the seed in. I mean, they would throw corn seed, beans, and squash. It would sort of throw it all together. And these crops would grow up together. And it was a remarkable arrangement because the corn provided this natural bean pole. And the beans worm their way up the corn. And the corn leaves would provide shade for the squash. And it was a kind of botanical orgy. But this worked. It was incredibly productive. It was not particularly labor-intensive. If weeds came in, they let the weeds come in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here you have this sort of black, charred land with trees all over the place and these crops sort of crawling all over each other. And the English,
looked
at that, and they said, what a disaster. Where are the fences? Where are the nice lined furrows?
Yeah.
You know, where's the land without weeds growing on it?
So the English, as you described them, were incredibly anal. They practiced monoculture. They separated things. They were great at distinctions. Mm-hmm. What's a fence anyway, but a way of making a distinction? Whereas Indians seem to be promiscuous and they mix things together. And how could they be a civilized people?
You're right. I mean, that was the perception. But there clearly was a sense initially anyway that the Native Americans could be incorporated and assimilated into English society, of course not on equal terms, but that they could be assimilated. And interestingly, one of the basic ways that some of these Puritans began to assimilate Native Americans was to give them cattle to domesticate. And I think that is an important reminder of just how culturally significant the act of controlling animals was to the English. I mean, if we could just get the Indians to control their animals, well, then that's half the battle.
Right. And get the guys out of the woods and back into the fields doing the proper man's work. which is having a miserable old time plowing up the earth and growing.
Well, the advantage there was huge. I mean, you're absolutely right. Yeah. You pull them out of the woods and suddenly this land becomes available in some ways. You know, you can then acquire it and you won't have Native Americans hunting through.
Yeah, that's convenient, isn't it?
Yeah.
So when and how did bagging deer and other wildlife become something essential to our ruggedly individualistic way of life? And when did people overcome the notion that eating trash food was a bad thing to do?
Well, I think this sort of cultural emphasis on the frontier and on hunting as being a sign of self-sufficiency, I think that became a positive cultural image when the burden of trying to emulate the English was lifted shortly after the American Revolution. The American Revolution really changed the dynamics fundamentally, I think, because it created this imperative that you have to kind of redefine now your culture. We cannot emulate the English. Of course, people did, but I think as the nation expanded west, as people moved to the frontier, there were these new expectations that could, instead of being looked down upon, could now be praised and somehow pointed to as a source of an American identity. So it's a bit of an irony that the dependency on hunting that they criticized, say, in the 17th century, in the early 19th century, actually became an element of what it meant to be an American.
Homemade food, country cuisine. Jimmy, you've given us some fascinating insights into one of the key moments in American cultural calendar, Thanksgiving, and we're grateful to you.
Oh, this was fun.
Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
Jimmy McWilliams teaches American history at Texas State University San Marcos. He's the author of A Revolution in Eating, published by Columbia University Press in 2005.
I'm a pilgrim and a stranger.
Now, Peter, it's interesting that from the very beginning, some English kind of dug the Indian way of doing things, right? I mean, there were they always had to worry that some English were going to say, hey, I kind of like the food snaking up and intertwining.
Oh, no question
and all that.
About it. Many people who were captured in Indian raids didn't want to be repatriated. They liked the Indian life. There wasn't any waste labor. But you could also say that what that represents in terms of food and its availability is a kind of feast or famine culture among Native Americans. When the food was ripe, you ate it.
Yeah.
You didn't wait for one day. You'd saved up stuff after the harvest. Of course, there were long periods during the winter when Native Americans had to live without. But when it was there, man, you just went for it. So the idea of regulating caloric intake is part of that whole anal business of English culture.
But so what you're saying, Peter, is that Thanksgiving is like fences, that it's a way of containing and controlling time as well as space.
That's a great point, Ed. And I would say it is just that. It's a fence. It's a marker. It's on the calendar. It's a way we organize our lives. And though we think we're overeating, it's a way of regulating eating because, of course, every day is not Thanksgiving.
Well, guys, it's time to open the gates in that fence and invite in our callers. Peter, I understand we got one more phone call. Who's it going to be?
Well, we have Marty calling from Naperville, Illinois. Marty, welcome to Backstory.
Hi, how are you?
Well, good. And we're thankful to have you on the line. What do you have for us?
I was wondering, has eating turkey in particular been an important way to emphasize patriotism during times of increased immigration?
Wow.
Boy, that had lots of different... I thought I was with you. And
it's a meaty question.
Well, here's my turkey immigrant thought, Marty. It is true that big city bosses whose positions often relied on massive turnout from recently naturalized immigrants to put them in office, they did deliver turkeys to the wards, to people who were hurting. This is late 19th century, early 20th century. But why it had to be a turkey instead of a ham, I don't know.
Turkeys are big. They're family-sized fowl, right? I mean, a chicken wouldn't do it.
It does strike me that turkey, I'm guessing, does not violate a lot of provisions of various religious traditions.
Dietary laws. That's ingenious.
I'm just guessing.
No, that is good. Yeah. That's good. Mm-hmm. Marty, we've really got to know it because part of our job here at Backstory is to interrogate people who have the good fortune to call us. Why do you care about this? What are turkeys to you?
Well, I work for a turkey company. And we have...
And are you trying to expand your market with immigrants?
Well, actually, we do have, at Butterball Turkey Talk Line, we have a Spanish website.
Terrific.
Muy bueno. Spanish talkers.
Vamos a hablar, Pablo.
I'm not one of them, though.
This is the Butterball phone-in. What is it called again, Marty?
Butterball Turkey Talk Line.
So what do people want to know when they call you, Marty?
Well, it depends on what week it is before Thanksgiving. Right now, I'm talking to you from Butterball University, and we're training.
We work there, too.
Yeah.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
You think I'm kidding?
So what do people want to know?
At the beginning, people want to know how much to buy, so they need quantity information.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes to how do I thaw the turkey, where do I store it until I'm ready to cook it, how do I cook the turkey. And then Thanksgiving Day, I haven't bought it, and how do I thaw it and cook it.
Now, is what we hear in the background, is that the turkey hotline in action?
Well, it is, actually.
That is so cool. Since this is radio, describe the scene at Butterball University for us.
Well, it's one big, large room painted blue and white with big posters on the walls giving approximate thawing times, depending on the size of the turkey and whether you thaw in the refrigerator or in a tub of water. We have another large chart for approximate roasting times in a 325 oven. There are 55 women here all talking at once.
And
sometimes.
Are they all women? Would people not have confidence in a male Butterball University grad?
No, because that person would have as much knowledge as the rest of us. We would love a guy to apply.
But you don't have any guys. Marty, let me ask you, what do you pay? Because the pay here at Backstory really sucks.
It's a fair wage.
Okay. Well, that's
terrific. Do you have higher-ranking professors there?
We have some women with PhDs.
All right.
It's a university, Peter. Will you pay attention?
Okay.
But you have to have some kind of a foods background. Most of the people have at least a home ec degree. Some are dietitians.
But I do have a question. Since we are a history show, I need to know, are there pictures of Indians and pilgrims there in Butterball University?
No. Pictures of turkeys.
I just think it would be so spiffy and so historically contextualized if you have some pictures of the first Thanksgiving around there.
I think also an insert right next to the giblets to backstoryradio.org as people unpacked their turkey.
Well, Marty, thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you, Marty.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks so much for being there. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Have a great Thanksgiving holiday.
Well, that unfortunately is all the time we have today. But as always, the conversation continues online. Step away from that stove. And when you do, come join us online.
I'm really hungry, but I do have enough energy left.